This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Tomorrow, on Earth Day, NHPR launches a new program about the natural world and how we use it. It's called Outside In, and if that sounds familiar, it may be because the show's been available as a podcast for about half a year now. Episodes have covered all sorts of topics, from a 12-year-old hiker who plans to climb Mount Everest, to what's behind the stench of ginkgo trees, to the waterfront debate over dock building. And on that last point, disagreements over what's the right way to enjoy the natural world, to access it, to be in it, are a frequent theme for Outside In. Tomorrow's debut broadcast tackles that through the tale of ultramarathoner Scott Jurek, who last year set the record for traversing the entire Appalachian Trail from Georgia to Maine. When he reached the trail's end atop Mount Katahdin in Baxter State Park, Jurek celebrated with a lot of people, a film crew, and some champagne. But the party violated the park's rules and its core philosophy as a place where true wilderness should prevail. So when Jurek was fined, it predictably set off a long-standing, larger debate about preservation and recreation, about who gets to define how we should engage with nature. Today in The Exchange, that's what we're talking about, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We had three guests for the hour. Malin Clyde is here, project manager of UNH Cooperative Extension's Stewardship Network. And Malin, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Also with us, Dave Anderson, director of education with the Forest Society and co-host of NHPR's Something Wild. And Dave, good to see you.
Good to see you too, Laura.
And also with us, Sam Evans-Brown, NHPR's environment reporter and host of that brand new show, Outside In, about the natural world and how we use it. The premiere broadcast is tomorrow at 3. And Sam, congratulations and thanks for being here today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, and Sam, let's start with the Scott Jurek story, because it really does open up a window on this bigger question about competing ideas of what it means to have a nature experience or a wilderness experience. So just backtrack for us, Sam, if you could, please. The founding father of Baxter State Park, Percival Baxter, what a great old-fashioned name that is. When did he found the park, and what was his idea of a wilderness experience?
So it was founded in 1931, but he actually didn't finish purchasing all the lands that wound up being part of this park, which is massive. I mean, it's over 150,000 acres until 1962, so he continued to add to it even after it was founded. And his idea was that it was going to be a place where sort of quiet contemplation of wilderness would dominate, and actually the initial fights over Baxter State Park were allowing sort of traditional uses of the land within that park. Were you going to be allowed to log? Were you going to be allowed to park? Hunt in the park, and park as well now. But anyway, the balance that they wound up coming up with is that 75% of the park is a wildlife sanctuary, but there's this corner, 25%, where you're allowed to hunt. And then within that 75%, it's you know, foot travel dominates. There are a few roads here and there, but the idea is that you drive to your campsite, you park, and you spend the rest of the time walking and camping by rivers and you know, enjoying the wilderness the way it was enjoyed way back when, before there were cars. And you get this conflict that occurred in the mountain is set up by the fact that you've got Baxter State Park, which is trying to encourage one kind of recreation, quiet, limiting the number of people who can get in each day. And then you have the Appalachian Trail Conservancy, which the AT, the, you know, that long trail that goes up the East Coast ends on top of Mount Katahdin, which is within Baxter State Park. And the AT is really trying to encourage more people to get outside. They're trying to get more people on the trail. And that's, you know, two sort of, you know, those two goals are kind of at tension with each other.
Well, and those two institutions then have different goals, different ideas about what the right way to enjoy nature is.
Yeah, exactly. And you really see this with, you know, the AT has kind of a laissez-faire approach. I mean, there are trails, long-distance hiking trails out west where you have to register your starting date. They place limits on how many people can be on a trail at a certain time. The AT doesn't do that. They just say, go do your thing. You know, we'll try to help you get to the end in sort of small ways, but this is up to you. Versus Baxter, which, again, has limits on the number of cars that they'll let in each day. And the AT sort of circumvents that system of control that they have in place, which, again, has been a long-standing point of tension between the two organizations.
What do you think, Dave? You were talking earlier about, before we went on the air, about your experience in Baxter and all the rules.
So you make reservations in advance. They open them on New Year's Day, and you know the rules in advance, and when you show up at the park, you're regulated. You are assigned a campsite. You're assigned an itinerary. There's no room for freelancing there. It's unlike the White Mountains where, end of the day, you pull over, get 200 yards off a trail, and you can sort of bivvy wherever you're at. When you're in Baxter, you submit to the regulations that govern that park. It's a state park, unlike New Hampshire's White Mountain National Forest, which is a federal property.
And philosophically, you, if you're going to go to Baxter, you gladly submit, as you said, to those rules because you get something in return.
I think so. And I think that's a really important thing to know, that sometimes you're protecting the resource and sometimes you're protecting the experience of what is pristine. And in Baxter, you go there because it's perceived as real wild wilderness. Thoreau was there. And you submit to the rules that govern that park, which are designed to protect the resource.
Yeah, I've been there actually many years ago, and it was unbelievable.
It's a gorgeous.
Very quiet and beautiful and so
forth. It's about 210,000 acres, and the White Mountain National Forest is more like 790,000 acres. So it's about a little less than a quarter of the acreage of the White Mountain National Forest.
Well, in the inaugural episode of Outside In, again, this is one of the stories, because it does set up this tension of what is a wilderness experience. I want to play a little clip from your show, Sam. Here's NHPR's Sean Hurley playing the part of Percival Baxter, presenting how he wants this land to be used.
I seek to provide against commercial exploitation, against hunting, trapping and killing, against lumbering, hotels, advertising, hot dog stands, motor vehicles, horse-drawn vehicles and other vehicles, aircraft, and the trappings of unpleasant civilization.
So, Sam Evans Brown, that's a pretty broad category, the trappings of unpleasant situation, including hot dog stands. So,
isn't that great, the trappings of unpleasant civilization? And what I think we tried to get across in the episode is that Baxter State Park, their interpretation of the mission that they were handed by Percival Baxter is an interpretation, because if you look at his writings, you do see that he is struggling to come to terms with this conflict as well. I mean, he's talking about how he wants the park to be open to the common man. He wants it to, you know, every citizen to be able to come and enjoy this, and yet he wants it to remain pristine. So I think that if you look at those writings, the tension was set up in the beginning, and then you've got circumstances that Percival Baxter could not have anticipated. I mean, social media on top of mountains and
selfie sticks.
Yeah, on top of flip flops, all the things that we sort of joke about in the episode. So the modern staff are tasked with taking this philosophy and translating it into policies. And it's fraught. It's a tough situation that they're in.
Well, Malin, it's not just Baxter, although it's such a great example. But I'd love your thoughts too on this broader idea of, you know, some people define a wilderness or nature experience one way, and some people define it another way.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of it comes down to what you're expecting, what you're hoping for, but also maybe even where you grew up and what your idea of being alone means. And for some people, running into two other people on their favorite trail is a disappointment. And that people like
two other people?
Well, yeah, I just heard that from somebody yesterday when I told them I was going to be on the show, that people are looking for – some people are really looking for solitude, and they're looking for – I think they keep their secret places quiet and to themselves in the hopes that they can have a really quiet experience for themselves out in nature. I think we all get a benefit from that kind of experience every once in a while. But for others, I was talking to somebody yesterday who said they grew up in New York City, and for them, their experience of quiet may be fine with 20 other folks out on the trail and seeing other people. It's actually a nice community building experience. So some of it is just what people hope for. And I think people are all over the map on what they're looking for. You know, if they don't see anybody else on a trail, some folks would find that discomforting.
A little creepy. What's wrong with this trail? Is there a grizzly bear running around somewhere?
Right.
Of course, we don't have those in New Hampshire. But what do you think, Dave? Have you had times when you felt like Percival Baxter, kind of grumpy that all the unpleasant trappings
of
civilization?
I'm a recovering wilderness snob.
And it's been
a 12-step program. But, you know, I remember in college at Plymouth State University going up Mount Washington with our outing club and having this righteous indignation at seeing somebody carrying a pink poodle and climbing out of one of the coaches or off the cog railway.
Everybody should experience this the way I do.
Right.
That's
or seeing
how you
somebody
felt.
Toss an orange peel and say that it's biodegradable and almost getting in a fist fight about it. You know, like, no, that orange peel is going to be there for 3 years. And really sort of feeling sort of self-righteous. To my experience at the Forest Society and trying to engage more people in the outdoors for the sake of building a constituency, that I now find myself smiling in very crowded places like Mount Major and Mount Monadnock. Mount Monadnock, 100,000 people a year. Mount Major, 80,000 people a year. Lost River Reservation. When I look at people who are comfortable because they're having a social experience, they feel safe among a crowd. And I now recognize that that's a gateway experience. So I've overcome that sort of indignation, and now I recognize that there are places that we need to engage the public in the outdoors. That's not to say that needs to be everywhere. And there we arrive at the tricky part, which is the balance. I think we all have to start with the idea that humans can create conflicts in managing the resource and also managing the people.
So you've had a complete turnaround. The more crowds, the better. This is great. More people loving nature the way that you do.
Know where to go. Pick your shots. I know where I want to hike and see a lot of people, and I know where I can go. Something like 80% of the use is on 20% of the trails in the White Mountain National Forest, which conversely means that 20% of the use is distributed across 80% of very lightly used and unknown places.
But you're not going to give us those on the radio?
No, not on air.
Okay.
We could talk after.
Yeah, right. Afterwards, I'll get your secret list. Melon, how about you? How does this fold into the work that you do?
Well, from where I sit, the Stewardship Network arose out of the fact that in New Hampshire, we've had this boom in land conservation in the last 20, 25 years, just protecting more than, I think it's, I don't know, 380,000 acres in the last 20 years, which is incredible. We're so lucky. Our citizens in many towns, my own town, I live in Durham, we voted for a municipal bond to protect land about 10 years ago. So there's been really this protect, protect, protect. We've got to save our resources, and people really believe in conservation here, which is really amazing. But I think there's been a little bit of a shift, particularly when the economy took a downturn, this realization, wow, that we own all this land or we've protected all this land, but people don't even know where it is. People don't have a connection to it. And so a lot of towns in my own town, we realized that we had done a lot of land protection, but somebody started saying in the town council, well, where is all this land? Where I don't even know where it is. There's no sign. How can I go out there? And I think that that was a real turning point for us on the Conservation Commission. And we've been working ever since to try and create that connection that Dave was talking about, getting people outside, training volunteers to lead nature walks, holding volunteer work days on our trails, and really putting up signs, something as simple as that, trying to get maps made of those properties. And so I think the Stewardship Network arose out of this sort of collective need by the whole conservation community to pay more attention to stewardship and caring for these new conservation areas, but also, you know, a backlog of hundreds of properties that are owned by towns and the federal government and the state, and really trying to engage volunteers to help care for these places and even just getting outside.
Go ahead, Sam.
When we talk about these conservation easements and providing public access to them, it does get tricky. My example is that I just moved into a new house. We have 30-acre conservation easement behind our house. There's this beautiful pond. There's potential for a lot of great trails that connect to some great mountain bike trails that, in city-owned land. And there is a public access on the easement. There's this little, 10-foot-wide stretch that's supposed to be for public access. But if I were to go and post a sign that says, public access to the pond on the road.
Come hike behind Sam's house.
Yeah, I'm not sure my neighbor would be so thrilled about
that. Where is
that,
Sam?
Yeah, exactly. I'll tell you, it's about 4 miles from the studio.
Is there any fish in there?
Well, it's funny. They did used to stock it, but I don't think they do anymore.
Well, I think that's a really important point. In talking about conservation land, and that's part of the educational mission of the Forest Society, is how is conservation land different from the concept of a park? Conservation land is often managed to protect natural resources, those air, clean water, wildlife first. And then sometimes that can include recreation. And parks are different. Recreation comes first in parks. Those are places for people. And yet we all kind of get thrown into the same hopper. And there's some subtle differences, but really important differences in setting expectations about the role of conservation land and how it's managed, and also the role of parks.
Again, our phone number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, we're looking at the longstanding question of balancing recreation with preservation. How wild should New Hampshire be? Who gets to decide what the rules are about enjoying the great outdoors? 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. If you've ever felt like Percival Baxter, you didn't want the unpleasant trappings of civilization impinging on your nature experience, let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. All of you, just getting back to the Scott Jurek story again for a moment, that was on Outside In. Sam, you guys interviewed Scott Jurek, and he had his own thoughts on, what it means to enjoy the wilderness. He was fined, first of all, for his little party at the top of Mount Katahdin.
Yeah, he had three separate fines, one for littering, one for having too large of a group, and one for consuming alcohol on the summit. Later, two of those fines were dismissed. He paid a $500 fine for drinking champagne on the summit, which is not allowed within park rules. Of course, lots of people do celebrate on top of Mount Katahdin.
Sure, it's a big accomplishment.
It's just that the park rangers had been alerted to the fact that he'd be up there, that he might have a film crew, which was going to break the rules. And so someone observed, just happened to catch him, versus lots of people who maybe have a beer on the summit and never get spotted. So that was part of it. He felt picked on because of his celebrity. He felt sort of used as a way to sort of – he was singled out. And maybe that was the case. Maybe they were trying to make a statement, but that's what happened.
So he was fined. He got two of the fines taken away. The film crew was a problem. Also, the fact that his ultra marathon trek of the AT was sponsored, right? Yeah. Had private sponsors. That was a problem, too.
Right, which is not necessarily against the rules of Baxter State Park, but it's against the spirit of the park. And so that was part of why I think he was, in fact, singled out by the park, is that he had corporate sponsors. He had a sprinter van that he was able to sleep in every night. It was a supported trek. He wasn't carrying all his gear. He had a team that was, ferrying his gear from location to location. And he was making lots of posts on social media with all the brands that were sponsoring him as a way of supporting the trip.
One of the problems that one of the park officials had was even his headband has somebody's logo on it. So it's that whole commercialization versus the pristine nature of nature. We're going to hear from Scott Jurek in just a moment, but let's hear a little bit from Jensen Bissell. He's one of the officials at Baxter State Park, and here he is kind of responding to the backlash that the park got when it censored Scott Jurek.
We just think this is inappropriate. We don't have any problem with people celebrating their accomplishments, but there are other places to do that are more respectful of the place itself and of the other people that are there.
Again, that is Jensen Bissell from Baxter State Park. Do you have quick thoughts on that, Dave?
I think that you look at the ultramarathoner, and he's in the Tom Brady realm of somebody who's just run the entire Appalachian Trail. And so in a way that, and almost counterintuitively, will probably draw more people to want to try things like that and actually could create a push for reservations at Baxter Park. I'd be interested to hear if they had more requests for reservations this coming summer as a result of the notoriety last year.
Or, Sam had this in his story, Facebook posts by people who said, I don't want my leisure time spent arguing with park rangers or being picked on by park rangers and so forth. So lots of back and forth. Let's hear from you in just a moment. 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking once again at the big questions surrounding who gets to decide what an outdoor experience really is, why it's so hard sometimes to find agreement on what wilderness really means. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. With us in studio, Malin Clyde, Project Manager of UNH Cooperative Extension's Stewardship Network. Also, Dave Anderson, Director of Education with the Forest Society and co-host of NHPR's Something Wild. And also with us, Sam Evans-Brown, NHPR's Environment Reporter and host of our new show, Outside In. It's a show about the natural world and how we use it. It's been available as a podcast for some time, but the broadcast premiere is tomorrow at 3. One more time, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. And just to finish up, Sam, on this story, again, in your premiere broadcast tomorrow of Scott Jurek and his issue celebrating the top of Mount Katahdin, he was fined. We talked about why he was fined. Some of those fines got pulled back. Here's what Scott Jurek told you about his take on the debate over what a wilderness experience really is. Let's hear.
Wilderness is a gift, and we need to take care of it, but we also need to, you know, be out there using it. We're thankfully blessed with an amazing country with vast resources and vast amounts of land where you can escape and be out in the middle of nowhere by yourself. There are other areas in wilderness where they're quite popular, and there does become an issue where some people are like, hey, I want my wilderness experience where I'm the only one out there. But in reality, as the human population grows and, you know, wilderness areas become more popular, the bigger issue is like how people view a wilderness experience and what that means. Because for some people, they're okay with having other people around. Other people would like to see wilderness maybe locked up and set aside and no humans whatsoever be a part of that landscape.
Again, that's Scott Jurek from the show Outside In. And Sam, he kind of hits the nail on the head there, doesn't he?
Yeah, and I think if you were to ask me my opinion here, which you didn't, but I'm going to give it to you, I think that really places like Baxter State Park have their work cut out for them in order to sort of, you know, preach their vision to the world. Because if you look at where the culture is headed, it doesn't seem like it's headed more towards this sort of contemplative, silent, quiet recreation. You know, I think the response to Jensen Bissell on social media really showed this, that a lot of folks don't get it. They don't understand what the big deal about Scott Jurek's celebration on top of Mount Katahdin was. So I think if you have an organization like Baxter that is looking for a different kind of enjoyment of wilderness, it's incumbent upon them to get the word out about why that's important and why their rules matter.
And maybe that's the way that things are going to go, Sam and everybody, that, you know, if you do want that experience, you go to Park A. If you don't want that experience, if you want, you know, a hotel or, you know, a hot hamburger or whatever, you go to Park B. Maybe that's the only way we're going to resolve this rather than trying to please everybody at one spot. Go ahead, Malin.
I think that part of the issue here, and I think Scott is actually from Seattle. We're in New England, and it's pretty dense here. We're lucky. We have a lot of trees. I think you can get some quiet.
You can hide behind a tree.
You can feel solitary in a pretty dense place. But I don't think it's by chance that some of these issues are really at the forefront here in New England, because out west, I'm actually from out west, and I'm actually from Alaska, where 99% of the land is owned by the public. There's just
more space. 99% of the land is owned
publicly
by the public?
It's incredible.
Either state or federal.
Federal or tribal lands or whatever. There's some sort of public ownership
and
public
mean?
Access.
What does that mean for people?
Well, I think the dynamic is different. I think there's much less private conservation land, but also much less privately owned land. And there is this there's not so much a sense of scarcity of getting out there and alone. There's plenty of space for if you want that wilderness experience. It's very easily attained. And I think here it's more precious. It's and there's more management required to sort of create that sense of wilderness. And I think, you know, across the West, it's very easy to get out by yourself and find a place. It may be an illusion. Even in Alaska, I think it's an illusion that it is actually, you know, nature unfettered and unmanaged. But I think in New England, you know, we have an incredibly great quality of life. We have a lot of green spaces and protected lands, but it does create more requirement for stewardship and management of people and the resource to create that sense of being able to be alone.
It must be really interesting for you, Malin, given your growing up in Alaska and then coming to New England, where we have all these debates about, you know, I saw 20 people on the mountain, that's too much, you know, I'm never coming back here again, or whatever, like the one we're talking about in Baxter. What do you say to your New England friends when people like the former Dave are feeling wilderness snobby?
Well, one thing is, I feel like there's a little bit more of an idea of protecting places, like not telling people how to get to beloved places, and a little bit more of an attitude of that's my secret spot or that's my community's secret trail, and we're not going to put it on a map, and we're not even going to put up a sign, but all the locals know how to find it. And really, as I think that's
Wait, are you saying there's something wrong with that? Because I've got a swimming hole that I am not going to tell you about.
I know. But, you know, we do in cooperative extension, and the Forest Society has been involved with this as well. The idea of what I'm most worried about is not that our special places are going to get destroyed. I'm most worried about that our culture is going away from kids spending time outdoors and not enough people feeling a real authentic connection to nature. And that worries me about the future of conservation, because if people don't have those authentic experiences outside and enjoying nature, why in 50 or 100 years are they going to be worried about protecting nature or, you know, doing any – put funding conservation? So that – I really feel like that's the bigger fear, and it's something that we tell when we train volunteers who might be worried about sharing a local favorite spot. They're worried that if they tell people about it, they might come wreck it. But really, that really we should be worried about nobody going outside at all.
That's the bigger worry.
That's my bigger worry.
That's interesting.
Plus that idea of hands off, you can't come here. There's sort of an elitism that's implied in that. And then we get into issues of sort of social justice and equal access to conserve land. And that's another whole kind of can of worms that comes up in the context of this discussion. Sometimes places need to be protected for their own sake. The Concord Reservoir has a chain link fence around it. Nobody would argue that, you know, that fence should be taken down.
Sure, it's drinking water.
We have an obligation to people who support conservation to prevent like ATV damage and massive erosion as a result of, you know, people riding on trails with motorized vehicles where they're not allowed. So there have to be rules. And then the question becomes, you know, who decides?
And how tough should those rules be?
Yeah, and the larger we as a society need to balance the protection of things like clean air, clean water, and wildlife with, you know, access for people to engender support for for conservation in the future. I mean, I'm with Malin on that issue. I love seeing school groups on Mount Major. I love seeing crowds enjoying Mount Monadnock. A conga line going up in Tuckerman Ravine this weekend as people go up to ski. I mean, it's a social experience, and they're loving the mountains.
Well, on this note, we've got a little clip here from the very famous and beloved naturalist, writer, painter David Carroll, known as the Turtle Guy here in New Hampshire. Here's an excerpt from David Carroll talking about this. And Dave, you know where I'm going, because this is an excerpt from an interview you did. Here's David Carroll talking about this exact issue that you raise, Malin, and that you raise, Dave. Here he is on NHPR Something Wild.
I can't really get on the Last Child in the Woods kind of bandwagon. First of all, I don't see the natural world as a cure for human dissatisfactions or disappointments. It is such a much more sacred thing than that. Oh, you know, I gave a lot of talks in schools, and then I show them slides of the places I go and all, and I talk about vernal pools. And I just stopped and I said, you know, I would love to take you, or I'd love to have you see a place like this. But I said, there are 55 of you. I said, that's 110 booted feet. The landscape can't bear that. It just can't. It's just impossible.
What do you think, Malin? 110 pairs of, or 110 booted feet?
Well, of course, it leads to there are places that can handle a lot of folks, and maybe it's not the local vernal pool that David loves, but
right,
I actually
delicate wildlife
yeah,
and so
I
forth.
I was really actually, I mean, I've been in natural resources for 30 years of my life, and reading Last Child in the Woods was actually really a transformative experience for me, and I really took a lot of the messages to heart. So maybe David and I disagree a little bit on that, but I think it's really important. It changed the way I parent my kids, just really actively trying to get them outside messing around in the dirt as much as possible.
Well, maybe a conversation between you and David Carroll is the next episode on Sam's show. Let's take some calls, all of you. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. What's the right balance between taking care of wilderness but also getting out and enjoying it? And why is it so hard to find agreement sometimes in this area? Give us a call. We'd love to know what you think. 1-800-892-6477. Again, email is exchange at nhpr.org. And all of you, let's go to New London first. Carter's on the air. Hi, Carter. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thanks for having me.
Sure.
So I just wanted to chime in here. I worked for the Appalachian Mountain Club, so I'm not speaking for them. I just want to make that clear. Up at Lonesome Lake Hut in the fall. And we have up in the high mountains, the huts up there, we have a lot of thru-hiker community that come through. And it was interesting after Scott Jurek had run through the huts to hear the aftermath of the thru-hikers that followed. And whereas I praise Scott for being, you know, a dominant ultramarathon runner, being prestigious in that community, it was interesting to hear what the thru-hikers' opinions were when they came through, and that he necessarily didn't always stay on the trail, and that he sometimes was camping with his crew, and that a lot of the time he would be kind of rude to thru-hikers of the other community, and that when he ended up at Baxter State Park at the end drinking champagne, and then the aftermath of all of that occurring through the community was very interesting to hear as kind of a crew member up in the whites listening to these thru-hikers. And
so
I just thought it was interesting.
He didn't just flout the rules at the top of Mount Katahdin, but you're saying, Carter, he kind of bent the rules while he was doing the whole trek.
That's correct. And I think a lot of the thru-hikers kind of took that as, well, this is our community, and here you are coming into it and opening up to a much larger conversation, and that what is the right thing to do when you're thru-hiking? What does it mean to be on the Appalachian Trail? And it was interesting to hear that, because my views changed a little bit when I heard about Scott Jurek running through the Appalachian Mountain, you know, through the AT. I thought that, wow, this is an amazing individual who has the stamina to do that. But then when you hear about these stories from other individuals along the way, it changes your point of view.
Yeah, Carter, good to hear from you. And just a point of clarification, Sam, a thru hiker is somebody who starts in Georgia and ends up in Maine, does that whole, you know, 2,000-mile AT, for people who might not know.
Right, and this sort of gets at a question about what counts as through hiking. I mean, Scott Jurek was supported, and a lot of people feel like if you're not just carrying schlepping your own gear, then this is some sort of bastardization of the spirit of the Appalachian Trail. And so that's a whole nother debate than the one we're on now. But it does sort of get to this issue. I mean, what counts as reasonable enjoyment of the wilderness? Are you really enjoying the wilderness if you're doing 10-hour days on the trail and sleeping in a van and going as fast as you can? I mean, and for a lot of folks, that doesn't sound A, appealing, or B, like he's really enjoying the woods in the right way. And I actually asked Scott Jurek about this, and basically he said, I've done supported hikes, I've done unsupported hikes. I think both modes of transit, modes of going through a trail are valuable in their own way. And this was just how I wanted to experience the AT this time around. And, he's catching flack for it here and there, but that it was his decision.
Yeah, absolutely. And last time I checked, it's a free country. And if he decides, that's how he wants to decide it, it's public land. So why not? We can poo-poo him and say, well, he should have stopped and smelled the flowers, and maybe he will when he's 60, but this is what he wants to do right now.
And just one real quick, you know, clarification. This is a little persnickety, but Scott Jurek's from Minnesota and lives in Boulder. He's not from Seattle. But I do think Mollen's previous point stands regardless. There's a lot of open space in Minnesota.
Right, and out west in general. Well, and on this question that you raised and that our caller raised also, Sam, you know, what does it mean to enjoy the wilderness in the quote-unquote right way? This has come up also with the Appalachian Mountain Club, which Carter used to work for. They want to build a new hut, the first hut in, you know, half a century in Crawford Notch, I believe. So they say, hey, you know, we're crowded. We're turning people away. This is a great way for families. You got little kids. Mollen talked about that. You got little kids who maybe can't do these ginormous hikes. Before I ask you guys about that, I do want to play a little bit. This is Paul Cunha. He's the AMC's vice president of operations. Here he is in an interview with Chris Jensen, kind of making the case for why the AMC should have this new hut in Crawford Notch. Let's hear.
It has been 50 years since we built our last hut at Mizpah Spring, and since then the use has tripled. We are basically at capacity right now, so we are turning away customers.
So that's their argument, Sam, that there's a lot of people. And again, little kids, as the population ages, maybe some of us can't scamper up the mountain like we used to be able to.
And many of those huts are pretty difficult to get to. I mean, if you look at Madison Hut, I mean, that's a serious hike if you want to spend the night in that hut. So what they've proposed is a hut in Crawford Notch. It's 2 miles off the road. It would be much more accessible. It would also make it easier to do a hut-to-hut traverse because right now there's 14 miles in between the two huts that this one is going to go in the middle of. So it would make it easier to hike hut-to-hut. And it's, again, it's this same discussion. It's accessibility and getting more people into the wilderness versus preserving the experience that I had. I mean, the folks who don't like this idea, they say Crawford Notch is a very special place. You're going to build a bunch of new parking lots. You're going to clear land for a helicopter pad near the hut so things can be flown in. And you know, we want Crawford Notch to stay the way it is, as you know, as unspoiled, quote unquote, as it is now.
It's a pretty busy place still, Crawford Notch, but a helicopter. I mean, my experience with the huts is that these fabulous young people, you know, spend the summer with giant backpacks trekking up and down and carrying the supplies.
Yeah, but you can't carry in a propane, you know, however big those propane tanks are. There's
Got
certain
it.
Things that they have to helicopter in and out, and also the construction materials. I mean, big beams, things like that have to be flown in.
Sure, just to get the thing built.
Yeah, sure.
I think I know what you're going to say, Mollen, but I want to ask you anyway. Again, you talked eloquently before about getting kids outside, helping people access nature, or no one will care about nature 50 years from now. What's your take on this AMC proposal?
Well, I live in southern New Hampshire, and I think the experience on the places that I spend my time is pretty different than it is in some of our highest profile places like Crawford Notch and Mount Monadnock and even Mount Major. And I know that so I'm not sure I have a position. I love going to the huts, particularly when my kids were little. I wanted them to love being outdoors, and putting a 50-pound backpack on a 50-pound kid was not apparently
– And going 14 miles.
Right, was not what was going to create a great experience for them. So, I mean, again, in Alaska, there are no huts. There's nothing like that. And I thought it was really – I felt like I was able to introduce my kids to being outdoors at a much younger age.
Because of that.
And they're teenagers now, and I can't say that they love being out doing wilderness.
It's a phase.
I know. I'm hoping. As I did. But I think it's been really great, and we have something pretty special here that we have that kind of experience that we're able to get people sort of halfway outdoors. And those places, those AMC huts, I feel like are incredibly well managed, and they provide a really unique experience and, you know, economic development for the area.
All right. Well, we will take more of your comments and questions in just a moment. I have a couple emails, too, I want to share with all of you. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at this question. What does it mean to enjoy nature, to experience the outdoors, the wilderness, and who gets to decide what is the quote-unquote right way to do it. Join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Malin Clyde is with us, project manager of UNH's Cooperative Extension's Stewardship Network, along with Dave Anderson, director of education with the Forest Society and co-host of NHPR's Something Wild. And also with us, NHPR's environment reporter, Sam Evans-Brown. Sam is also host of Outside In, NHPR's new show about the natural world and how we use it. One more time, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And all of you, let's go back to our listeners. And Hector joins us from Wolfboro. Hi, Hector. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Hector, you're on the air. Good morning. Okay, Hector, I hope you call back. I've got a couple emails, too, I wanted to share with both of you, all of you. Here's one from Marjorie, who says, Governor Percival Baxter tried to get the state of Maine to purchase the land to protect this incredible resource. When the state did not agree, he used his own money and gave the park to the state with his rules intact. Marjorie says, every great natural resource does not have to be protected or purposed in the same way. Marjorie concludes by saying, Baxter, the person and the park, stand as one valuable model. Dave Anderson, this is something we sort of talked about before. If you don't like Baxter's relatively strict rules about wilderness and quiet, go somewhere else.
Right. And also, you know, hats off to Marjorie, because I can't agree more that, you know, buy it yourself. And, you know, we rely on donors at the Forest Society to help us protect land. Today, we own a total of 185 forest reservations. That's 54,000 acres. And those are managed for multiple uses, just like the White Mountain National Forest is. However, you need to balance the protection of the natural resource values and then see if you can provide recreation. We also need donors to help us support the stewardship for the resource that enables that: trails, parking areas, kiosks, gates, signs, those types of things.
And how much of those types of things you want to put in and how much you don't. Because
exactly.
When you start saying trails, parking lots, kiosks, I thought, okay, how far is he going to go? You know, the dreaded
hot dog stand.
That Percival Baxter. I spent some time in 2013. We took our family out to a big, you know, the classic American Western trip, and was struck, Dave, at, of course, how beautiful our national parks are, celebrating 100 years old this year, but also just how commercial they were. I mean, wow.
Right. You know, if you build
big
it,
gift shops,
if you build it, they will come.
And
so there's the other converse argument that leaving places undeveloped and undisturbed are not going to draw those crowds. And there's certainly enough room for both. And we need to determine where we do that.
Do you want to jump in, Sam?
I was just going to say that if I've received any pushback to our episode about the Scott Jurek kerfuffle, it's from folks who really like Baxter State Park. And basically their response was, listen, if you don't like this, you don't have to go. You can go to a national park where they really go to the other extreme. It's all about access. They're trying to get as many people onto
right.
those trails as they can. They pave. They, you know, there are ramps. It's handicap accessible.
Buses.
Yeah. And so they're like, you know, Baxter State Park is a unique place. It's being managed in a unique way, and so don't pick on them. Leave them alone.
Well, that's Marjorie's point. You
yep.
know, it's Baxter's money and Baxter's land, and he gets to set the rules, and if you don't like it, go somewhere else. Let's go to Campton and talk to Joe. Hi, Joe. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. With all of the trends in the last, I don't know, 10, 15, 20, 30 years of defunding various things, both at the federal and state level, and the privatization I'm not a big fan of privatization, but I'm wondering what the group thinks in terms of the concern that there might be privatization of the management of federal and state forests down the road as state and federal budgets continue to be cut back. And are they concerned about that? Do they think it may happen? And B, if it does, is there a concern about what the outcome might be when it does?
Interesting. Joe, thank you so much. Malin, do you want to jump in on that?
Sure. I haven't really seen here in New Hampshire a trend towards commercialization or trying to partner as much with private industry about essentially stewardship and trying to figure out a way to pay for the caring of our trails and natural areas. But I do think actually the Stewardship Network New England project was started a couple of years ago because of this broad concern by federal agencies, state agencies, towns that own land, and conservation groups that they're struggling with stewardship. And they are struggling with caring for the land and trails. But what I see is, and so we're trying to mobilize volunteers to help with this. And I think it is the it is where we are right now. There's an incredible history in New Hampshire of volunteers taking care of trails. I think I've seen, you know, the snowmobile clubs and the mountain bike groups are incredible about taking care of trails and having good use, you know, appropriate use, driving out bad use, which might be trash, you know, trash piles and partying and that kind of thing. But it does take people to organize those volunteers. And, you know, that requires an investment. And I'm actually was really excited to hear 2 years ago that the New Hampshire State Parks, which struggles in terms of its funding, but they made it a priority to hire a volunteer coordinator for the first time in my knowledge ever. So they have somebody who the trails groups that do almost all of the upkeep of all of the trails on the state parks have a point person who can provide training and keep things organized and have plans for what trails get fixed.
Go ahead, Sam.
I was just going to say the privatization of the management of national parks, because there are so few national parks in the East, it's really kind of a Western debate. You know, Acadia is the only national park that we have out here. And you know, privatizing the Forest Service running the National Forest here in New Hampshire is just not something that has been talked about.
You know, as we talk about our caller's question about, you know, more privatization and so forth, and this question we keep getting back to, who gets to write the rules? As we said, you know, Percival Baxter got to write the rules, Dave, for Baxter State Park. But it does get tricky, doesn't it? I mean, you've got New Hampshire State Parks. Okay, so they write the rules about how to use that. You've got Forest Society lands. Owners and the Forest Society get to decide. And then the White Mountain National Forest is a whole other animal. It's not really a national park.
U.S. Forest Service, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, how do you figure that all out, either as a user or as someone who cares about
nature? At the end of the day, what's common to all of those organizations is that they hold land and manage land in the public trust. So they have that duty of care to take care of the resource. And there's a story in National Geographic in the May issue that just came out about Yellowstone National Park. Are we loving it to death? And the greatest threat is sort of the nibbling away at the boundaries of these wilderness areas, nibbling away at the boundaries of national parks and national forests with development and gateway towns and selling of, you know, real estate because it's a beautiful place to be. And so, you know, it's like Pogo said, you know, we've seen the enemy and it's us. So when it comes to national lands and protecting land, it's a finite resource. And eternal vigilance is the price of freedom to keep what we've made, those gains. And when we start to look at public lands like the White Mountain National Forest, and the Forest Society traces its origins to the struggle between 1901 and 1911 to pass the Weeks Act, and that's the land of many uses. You just drive up the highway, and when you arrive, it says, welcome to the White Mountain National Forest, land of many uses. And then we begin to argue about which uses are allowable. It's almost like interpreting what the founding fathers wanted when it came to issues they couldn't possibly foresee. So when I walk into a wilderness area, and I see somebody waving a selfie stick, now I'm going to relapse back. Somebody's waving a selfie stick. Somebody else is flying a drone. I mean, they're doing really rad and extreme things, and they're posting it on their Instagram feed, and it just doesn't sit well. And so it's the little nibbling away at it that caused me to feel like we really need to be careful about throwing wide the gates.
Although if somebody posts, you know, Mount Monadnock or, you know, whatever on their Instagram and 200 people see it and they all go, wow, you know, I really want to go there. You know, I mean, my kids love Instagram. Right. They'd be like, Mom, take me there.
Yeah, and Mount Monadnock's a great example. 100,000 people a year climb Mount Monadnock. The Forest Society owns 4,500 acres there. The state park is 1,200 acres. It's about 7,000 acres. And it's a hardened landscape that's a gateway experience. It's a formative experience, especially for Boston school groups, just like Mount Major is a formative experience or Mount Agamemnicus is a formative experience for people in the seacoast of New Hampshire and Maine. I have no problem with that because it's great, because it's safe, it's accessible, it's doable, and it doesn't, it's not a pristine wilderness.
And if you want that pristine experience, you go to Baxter.
You go to some other place.
All right. Malin, I can see you want to jump in, and then we need to go to our listeners. Go ahead.
Well, I would just argue that there's a lot of really unknown, really nice places to get outside and actually have a quote-unquote wilderness experience in our own communities. And the problem is, of course, I see, is that those are hard to find because they're not on a map. And mm-hmm. in my own town, Many of them, again, don't have a sign. There's no way to know where they are.
Getting but, back, we want to keep those quiet places quiet.
Yeah, but there's, I think there is a trend to try to help connect people to local places so that you don't have to get in your car and drive an hour and a half up to the White Mountains.
Right.
That there's some really amazing places, you know, owned by the Forest Society or also owned by towns. That might be lesser known and that could maybe take some of that pressure off. You know, you might not have a view of Lake Winnipesaukee, but there are views to be had, and very few people are using those places.
Okay, well, I personally would like that information because weekends are busy and sometimes I do not have time. Well, most of the time, I don't have time to drive up to the White Mountains.
If you go to the Forest Society's website, of the 185 properties, we've actually chosen the best 45 properties. We sort of stratified those out and say these are the places that can support recreation. They have the magical five things: the gate, sign, kiosk, parking, and a sign. When you get there, it feels like you've arrived someplace. The other places aren't marked on maps. They're not promoted. They're on back dirt roads, and they're quiet, rural, and, you know, intentionally those are places that are not being managed extensively for recreation.
Let's take another call. This is Ivy in Peterborough. Hi, Ivy. Go ahead. You're in the Exchange. Welcome.
Hi, thanks. I'm calling because I'm coming at this from a slightly different perspective. I have done some hiking in the United Kingdom on supported walking trails, which is not a thing that we have in the United States much. And I have decided that maybe New Hampshire needs a long-distance supported walking trail, which would use some of those trails that we've been talking about that are in the towns, and linking them up in ways so that you can walk from pretty little town to pretty little town, carrying your lunch and walking to a B&B or walking someplace where the B&B owner can meet you. You can sleep, spend the night in the bed, and walk another 12 miles tomorrow.
So kind of like the huts, but a little less rigorous.
Less rigorous and, you know, geared to, you know, some people walk the West Highland Way in 4 days. Some people walk the West Highland Way in 12 days. You choose your stage length for what you can manage and what you want to do. Do you want to stop and paint? Do you just want to keep walking? And I'd just like to hear, I've started to talk to people at the state level about, could we do this? And I've been calling it the Desire Line Pathway. We want it, therefore we will have it.
You know, Ivy, this is really interesting. So many thoughts here. First of all, Sam, we keep hearing New Hampshire's an aging state, so maybe people want to get out and enjoy nature but don't want to bump their way through the whites.
So this reminds me, a couple of years ago, we did a hike. We did a hike in the Pyrenees where we went backpacking for 8 days. And I will tell you, the hiking experience in Europe is very, very different. It's much more built out. There are lots of mountain towns that you go from town to town. It's, you know, it's hard to go more than a day without being in civilization. And so this is a totally legitimate way to enjoy or to mix built environments with wilderness. And the question is, you know, is that something that Americans writ large would participate in? I mean, if there's enough people to do this, you'd imagine that this supported hiking trail would exist already. Maybe 20 years down the line, we will have something like
that. Well, and I know a couple of people who've done this in England. You walk from coast to coast and you stop. My parents did it when I was Yeah, exactly. Go ahead, Malin.
Well, I was going to say there's a group of folks in cooperative extension in the community development field. And they work with a lot of rural towns, and there's some interest. They've been doing some research on trails as a driver of economic development. And so how to, again, try to promote some of our existing, you know, incredibly great resources. But it does require, because of our land ownership patterns, it does require a lot of collaboration and agreement among the folks who might own the land. And it might be a land trust, a town, a state park. It goes on and on and on. Private landowners, certainly many of them have trails that they allow the public to be on. It's complicated land ownership pattern here, but I admire her chutzpah to try to pull that off.
Do you want to jump in, Dave?
Yeah, I do. I like the idea of bed and breakfast and local ice cream stands. We've talked about putting up a Forest Society reservation.
But no hot dog stands.
No hot dog stands. Hike here, go down to the lake, take in a view, get an ice cream cone, and then, you know, so while you're in the area and trying to partner with local businesses. So the idea of bed and breakfast and supported recreation, that's one of the really key things, is support for recreation, that infrastructure. The stewardship obligation to take care of trails is actually pretty significant. Everybody wants to build a new trail. Everybody wants to create something new. And there are so many trails that are languishing and in need of volunteers and people to help take care of what we have and increase, as Mullen says, awareness of what's out there, that this concept of engaging the business community, recreation and tourism, I mean, we are vacation land, and using that support for recreation to help take care of the recreation infrastructure and help deal with the burden of the stewardship of those properties.
It's kind of human nature, Dave, isn't it? People like the shiny and new, but once it's built, they move on, and somebody needs to do the drudgery of just the day by day.
So supported recreation sounds like support for recreation. That sounds like a great thing from the perspective of an organization that's protecting land and charged with managing and maintaining trails.
Go ahead, Mullen.
Maybe Baxter State Park should have asked Scott Jurek to use his considerable celebrity to host a volunteer work day on the AT at the end. I think they could still do that. They could invite him back. But, you know, that to try, there is a lot of interest by the trails community to try and convert growing enthusiasm for hiking and the 4,000 Footers Club and stuff like that, to try to somehow also create a culture of stewardship and try to engage more people in trails. And so the Stewardship Network, any group can post a volunteer work day on the Stewardship Network, and people can sign up just to participate just on their phones. So we're trying to make it easier to do that volunteering.
Well, here's an email from Chris in Spofford who says, I've been playing in the White Mountains since I was a kid. I can relate to your panel member, Dave, who used to be snobby but now has a broader perspective. I guess an easy solution, he says, for those who want more solitude would be to go hiking in winter. You'll need more gear, but the snow creates a beautiful silence, and not many are willing to brave the elements at that level. Chris, thank you for the email. Sam Evans-Brown, I have to ask you real quick, just give us the details on this big broadcast tomorrow.
Yeah, Outside In, we're going to run 5-hour-long shows for the next 5 weeks. They're going to be airing Fridays at 3 and again Saturdays at 2. So listen in and tell us what you think.
And always a podcast.
Always a podcast, all summer long.
All right. Well, NHPR's Sam Evans-Brown, congratulations, by the way, on
thank
the
you.
Show. And we'll look forward to hearing it. Thanks for being here, Sam. Dave, thank you also for being
thank
here.
Thank you. Happy Earth Day.
Dave Anderson, Director of Education with the Forest Society, co-host of NHPR's Something Wild. And Mullen Clyde, it was really nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks a lot.
Mullen Clyde, Project Manager of UNH Cooperative Extension's Stewardship Network. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Jessica Hunt. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Laura Kanoy.